Hi everyone, I'm Pamelia Chia and you're listening to the Singapore Noodles Podcast, your go-to destination to learn about Singaporean food culture. Today I have on the show Gan Chin Lin, who is the person behind the Instagram account Tumblin Bumblin Crumblin Cookie. And in this following conversation, we chat about Asia's history with vegetarianism, privilege and our food choices, as well as food education in Singapore. I really enjoyed this chat and I hope that you would feel the same about it. So I know that you're vegan. So what really started you on this journey of wanting to reduce your impact on the environment and eating less meat?
I do think vegan can be a very tricky term. I would say that I consume a plant-based diet and of course stay away from animal products. But I think like many other people, I first looked at it as through the lens of food or like a diet choice primarily. And I think that came, that consciousness came through. I was thinking about this the other day, but in primary school, I was in dance CCA. And sometimes when we had like competitions or performances, then people would have like dietary restrictions and they'll be like vegetarian and something like that. And I do remember like a few occasions I wouldn't mind, like there would be a misorder or miscommunication and I would be like, okay, let me try the vegetarian meal. And they would have those kind of mock meats, those made out of gluten and whatever to imitate char siu. And I would be like, oh cool, this is what they eat instead. And yeah, that's where I first kind of got to understand what it was like through a packed styrofoam box. But I think that expanded once I got really into reading food blogs and like really passionate about cooking and recipes, and I would see, you know, alternative baking and be like, what's this ingredient and what's that ingredient? And I guess it just expanded from there. And yeah, I decided to just do it myself. Yeah.
So when was this? When did it start?
Yeah, I would say that I gave up all animal products for majority of the times by secondary three, around there. Yeah, so it was from around there that I guess you could say that I made a shift, and from the kind of diet shift came a lifestyle shift as well. Once you educate yourself more and it's like, okay, you know, once you make a stand on a certain area, you have to ensure that it's reflected throughout. Yeah.
And was it difficult for you to make that shift?
It is true that there is that kind of notion that Asian parents, or at least a certain generation, can be a little stickier around the notions of foregoing meat. It becomes a very clutching of pearls, like, oh, you're gonna shrivel from protein deficiencies, calcium deficiencies. And I would say that, of course, my parents did have that instinctual knee-jerk reaction, I guess predominantly my mom, because she was in charge of the cooking. But yeah, looking back, it must have been more difficult in the moment, but I would say that she did get to a more compromising stance in the end and gradually bought more tofu. And I guess I also couldn't be too stringent about it. Like if she made a dish with like pork and like vegetables and picked up the vegetables for me, I wasn't going to refuse it. And I don't think that I will refuse it even today, like in big like family gatherings or anything. If someone picks out vegetables or like non-animal products thing from something that may have, say, anchovies in the broth, I'm not going to refuse it, especially if it doesn't have a lot of animal gristle on it, or if they clean it for me. You know, that's such a kind and genuine gesture, and cooking is always such a labor of love and care. And yeah, I don't see anything wrong in that. I feel like nowadays people get very hung up on identity markers or big umbrellas to categorize people, and I think that can really enforce a certain kind of group thing that runs very wild on the internet nowadays and can only lead to like further tribalism and like cut society into very immovable stances. And I do hope that we can come to a discussion, like we being a society in general, where we can think more fluidly about things while still holding to our personal principles, of course, but just not be so immovable about having to see everything in narrow typecast categories. Yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying, because I feel that every time you declare like, oh, you know, I'm going to adopt a new plant-based diet, everyone is trying to pick at bones or like pick out inconsistencies in your lifestyle or your diet, right?
Yeah, precisely. And I do think that, you know, it is a part of human nature to be quite curious about what people eat. Like, you know, even when you're in the supermarket and checking out, or at least for me in my personal experience, there's always going to be some auntie or uncle just like staring at my basket. I'm like, just let me check out my brinjals in peace. But I think that, you know, it's quite natural, again, like, to judge people by what we put in our baskets. And there is a lot of this kind of idea that you can tell a lot about a person through the food that they buy and they eat. And, like, and this kind of literalism really becomes a very profitable chunk of our contemporary food culture, right? You see all this kind of rhetoric about junk food makes for, like, dirty diets, and then by proxy dirty people or like drunk people. And when people see a dish that's like unfamiliar, then they think that the people who eat it by proxy also become, you know, strange and different from the way they are. So, and obviously these are very wrong categorizations to make, right? So I think it's really worth like questioning the assumptions about what we view as like normal or like plain or good or right or wrong in food. And, you know, yeah, often these judgments, I do think, you know, say much more about the person airing them than they do about the person who is actually doing the eating. Yeah.
Can I ask what exactly was in your basket that the aunties or uncles felt were like a bit strange?
It wasn't really a particular item, but they would just have that kind of, like, you can see the mental scanning going through their brain. They're like, what's she buying? Like, why is there like two packets of tau kwa? Is she buying for herself or like a family? You know?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting how, you know, these behaviors or these ingredients that used to be so common in our diets, right? I mean, before this abundance of meat started coming into play, I mean, Chinese societies used to eat really simply, right? Or Asians, Asian communities in general.
Yeah, you're so right, because you see all this kind of instinctual, like, knee-jerk alarm when you see the term veganism, but vegetarianism and veganism is actually so inherent to Asian cultures, like temple food in Buddhism, and which is satal yumshik in Korea. And I'm not sure if you watch Chef's Table, but there was Jong Hwan, the episode of Jong Hwan, the Buddhist nun who became famous. And I think she even released a cookbook recently. Yeah, and the equivalent of that is Shojin Ryori in Japan, which is like so ornate. And you have all those elaborate kind of setups. And even in Singapore, we have Jai Tai. I think it's called Jai Tai. Yeah, and the Singapore Buddhist Lodge provides free meals, I think. But I'm not sure about their COVID protocol. Yeah, and even the whole concept of imitation meat, like the packets of fake char siu or whatever, was, if I'm not wrong, they were actually made as like a substitute for the monks' transitional period from non-vegetarian to vegetarianism, and also for their family or friends who would visit them at the lodge. So yeah, our culture has always made space and had room for these kind of ideas. It's only because of what has been normalized and how society has progressed and aged, and of course industrialization and all that, that now these things seem like foreign or very niche or radical in some senses, and people can be afraid of that, I guess. Yeah.
And do you think there is an element of class that comes into adopting a vegan diet or vegetarian diet?
I think that is certainly one of the assumptions a lot of people have, right? And like the idea that you have to purchase all these ingredients or like substitute products. But I don't think it's an issue of privilege at all, to the extent that, I mean, of course it is true that to choose what you eat is definitely a privilege. Like, not everyone can exercise that autonomy, especially if they are, say, relying on coupons or like food stamps, for sure. Yeah, but, you know, there's also, during this pandemic, you see the news about spikes in the virus and many like workers at meat processing plants just getting infected over and over and infecting everyone else. And you can clearly see where the bottom line is or isn't in this industry. And of course, these workers are minimum wage workers, you know. They're also not the top tier of society. If we can hold the truth that, you know, not everyone can make the decision to choose what is on their plate, you must also know that these are the same people that are being affected by the meat industry and the dairy industry and all these kind of like structures that I think are at the core of why people choose veganism in the first place, to kind of protest against or like not to subscribe to anymore.
And I understand that you study in the UK and you come back to Singapore once in a while for visits, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm currently finishing my undergraduate in English and related literatures. So I wouldn't say that I kind of live in the UK. I just went there for my studies and yeah, I've been stranded here for a while. I still have to graduate, so fingers crossed it will be okay. Yeah.
So in that sense, you know, when you were living in the UK, did you feel like the culture around veganism or the conversations around it was very different from what you experienced in Singapore?
I don't think that they are more open to the idea, especially in the ways veganism has become very hip to marketing in the food department and food scene there in particular. They are quite more well-versed in alternative products and what these mean, whereas I think in Singapore, some people don't really understand, you know, the clear delineations, if there are any, I guess the state diet-wise ones for like veganism and vegetarianism and all that. But in the UK, there's quite a flourishing plant-based market based on all these kind of like milk substitutes, dairy substitutes, cheese, even meat substitutes. And yeah, it was definitely quite eye-opening, I think, when I first stepped into the various supermarkets. And you know, they kind of have a tier, the same way we have, you know, Sheng Siong Giant and then NTUC, FairPrice Finest, and then Cold Storage. They also have like Sainsbury's, Asda, Tesco's, all these. But even at those that weren't, say, the swankiest like Waitrose, you could still find one or two like vegan products, in the sense that it'll be like, oh, a pot of coconut yogurt. And yeah, I do think that that part was quite encouraging to see, even though it was very like eye-opening, I guess, when you first go there and you're like, wow, I don't know about you, but I do like to browse the supermarkets whenever going to a foreign country. It's really fun.
Yeah, me too. I love it because you really get a sense of what people are eating, right, in a different country. But why do you think that is? I mean, do you feel that it's because people overseas or in the UK are more environmentally conscious? That's why there are more, there is more, like a greater range of vegan products or meat substitutes compared to Singapore?
It's not so much about a scale of progressiveness as I think who is driving the cultural conversations about food in the first place. You see, in the UK, there are lots of these like contemporary products and like vegan desserts, even in the supermarkets, like packaged and like vegan ready meals and all that. And it is very aligned to what people are eating in the now. You know, there's a little bit for everyone, like the kind of Mediterranean fashion that is quite popular nowadays in many recipes, and a whole range of like things that you can feed differently. But I think in non-Western countries, people still practice veganism through food in very accessible and natural ways, but it just doesn't reflect in the market because we are very used. I mean, what we see in the media and all that is very driven by a Western hegemony. So we may not see what is already around us, if that makes sense, because we are always seeing them as like on the forefront of innovating and what dominates like the global news. Yeah, so I mean, even in Singapore, I guess that we, like what I kind of mentioned previously, we do have all these kind of vegetarian and meat substitutes all along. They're just sitting in quietly in a shelf there. But in the UK, once you repackage it in something more trendy and like bitsy, it becomes new and exciting, and then people will take fresher notice of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that point that you just made. And I realized that that was reflected in a lot of things that you cook on your Instagram, right? I realized that you make a lot of vegan char siu, and you do a lot of techniques that my mom taught me, like frozen tofu, right? Like you would.
She taught you that.
Yeah, and I was like, how did you know about this? I didn't know about this. Yeah, so I mean, when I was looking at your Instagram, I realized that you actually went back and you know, drew upon the wisdom that was naturally inherent in Asia. So, I mean, how did you know where to look, or, you know, how did you gain that kind of inspiration?
Yeah, it's really funny, isn't it, that all these methods are actually things that people have been practicing for a long while. I guess for me, I had to kind of like forge my own path. When it comes to substituting meat products, a lot of people can only imagine kind of like the didactism of you have to swap one protein for another protein. But I think that it really expands your horizons when you think about taste and experience and how a substance reacts to heat over duration of time. And yeah, say for example, eggplant, it has a kind of like slightly gelatinous set to it, which can be a bit like eel or like codfish, those kind of strains of fish that have a certain gel-like bite to it. So I've seen people make unagi with it, or even treat it like milk fish. I have a friend called The Foodie Takes Flights. She's not called that, that's her handle. She's called Jika, she's from the Philippines, and she uses eggplant instead of milk fish to make bangus, which is a Filipino dish. And a lot of these tricks that I learned from YouTube, where there's this really sweet vegan lady called Irene, and all her videos are in Chinese with English subtitles, but she does so many methods, like filleting oyster mushrooms by holding the knife at an angle and slowly turning the oyster. And then once you pound it with a rolling pin, it turns out that the mushroom splinters in the same way that can easily mimic the mouthfeel of, say, chicken meat or like chicken muscle. Yeah, and once you layer those with cornstarch, you can get a very satisfying bite. Or even things like enoki mushroom, so you cut off the slightly nasty part and you mix it with tofu paste, and then you wrap it in beancurd sheets and you fry it, and then you have a fish that kind of flakes. Yeah, I saw somebody on Instagram called Jackie, she's also a Singaporean, called her handle is Beef of Veganista, but she used this method to make sambal stingray with chinchalot. Yeah, which was really cool to see. Yeah, and I've even seen people use a baguette crust and a set tapioca kueh layer, and then deep fry the whole thing to make sancheng ro, which is triple layer roasted pork, yeah, the Chinese way. Yeah, so it's really interesting to see the diverse ways people try to reimagine certain memories of food. I would say that they are replicating meat wholesale. I think there's a certain extent to which these recipe makers and cooks know that this is not a real thing, but it's just so clever and so creative the way different ingredients and what we already have in our fridge can be recombined, and then you get closer to a memory. And I think that that part is what counts, because that is in itself as nourishing as what you eat, you know. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, someone needs to print that and slap that on a book, because it was I got goosebumps. It was amazing. I really can sense that excitement that you feel when it comes to seeing the way people, you know, are using their culinary resourcefulness, right, and ingenuity to transform vegetables. And I think that was what really drew me to vegetarian kind of, I mean, historic vegetarian cooking techniques. Because to me, I'm not so keen on like a sausage made out of, you know, lab-grown meat, or you know, impossible, what do they call it? Impossible burger? Impossible.
Yeah, impossible meat, beyond burgers.
Yeah, so I mean, when I learned about how, you know, people are, I mean, in the temple, I mean, they call it the temple cuisine, right? The monks were actually transforming gluten into wonderful things. And, you know, yeah. It's just amazing how a bunch of flour and some water can transform into this chewy thing. And the way they would braid it together to form like those meat-like strands, right? When it comes to char siu, it just blew my mind and I was so fascinated. So do you feel that you became a more creative cook since you became vegan?
Yeah, I would say I definitely have. You have to, as much as I don't like to think about veganism in terms of cooking as limitations, there is a certain, you do have to work around certain things. Like I do a lot of vegan baking, so you have to replicate the different purposes of egg in many different forms. And for that, you have to use entirely different ingredients in entirely different ways. And that can be a lot to grapple with. But once you really embrace that you have to learn, it can be so fun. It can be so rewarding as well. Yeah, there's a lot of joy to be taken in it. And I think that's the part a lot of people don't see it. They just see that, oh, we have to no longer eat meat. You cannot consume egg anymore. And of course, once you focus on that, it can seem very limiting. But once you focus on what you do have, it's like, wow, there's a whole new world of possibility that can be opened up. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, you know, just speaking about desserts or sweets in Asia, like a lot of them are actually vegan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think what is fascinating is, you know, discovering the intersection between our culture and our heritage and new ways of eating, like veganism or plant-based diets. And what I've realized is that sometimes the definitions of what is vegetarian or what is vegan differs from country to country or religion to religion, right? So recently, I was reading up about mithai, which is traditional Indian sweets. And you know, because the Indians, they revere the cow, they see the milk as sacred. And so a lot of the sweets, they don't have eggs, but, you know, it's made from milk. And so I was just wondering, is it ever possible for an Indian person to go vegan? Because, you know, it's such a big part of their culture, this reverence for the cow and its milk.
Yeah, that's the thing. There was actually an article published yesterday for Slate. I think if I'm not wrong, the author was called Iman Ismail, but it was basically about Impossible Pork and him being a Muslim and how, you know, whether it was halal. And I think that the article didn't really come to a definite conclusion, as is expected, because it would differ to different people. But I did enjoy like reading the different perspectives. And in particular, he actually asked his mom, and his mom gave a very kind of like spiritual approach. Like, God made everything permissible except pig. So it's not like we don't have many options. What, you know, she gave that kind of answer again, which is to, why do I need to consume something that is pop-like in an image when I really have so many things? But I do think that when it comes to religion, especially, it's not for anyone to dictate what anyone else's kind of like spiritual and ethical boundaries are. And that has to be something that that individual person grapples with. And again, it's a matter of individual conscience, you know, like at the end, all we can do is kind of be open to different kind of perspectives, but understand our own principles in the first place. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I do think there is a definite special relationship with the animal and different ethnicities and how we understand it. Like even for us, like being Chinese, there's a lot of superstition and whatnot around different dishes. And I do remember like, even the banquet style steamed fish, there's always this thing about, oh, if you eat the eye, it brings you luck, that kind of thing. So it's very, the way we consume animals definitely is very entrenched into our daily lives and our upbringing. Yeah, so that definitely is something that people have to navigate on their own terms with their understanding of the contemporary world and how that is changing around us, I guess. Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, as a Chinese, right, the more I learn about my own culture, the more I realize that pigs or pork is so intrinsic to our culture. You know, the word family, like jia, right, it's actually a roof and a pig under it. Because like pigs used to be living in the house with the family, right? And, you know, it was a domesticated animal. And so I was just thinking, you know, would I lose my culture? Would I lose my heritage if I were to change the way that I eat? And I came across one Instagram story that you were writing about this issue, and you wrote something about something along the lines that you believe that veganism and our heritage can coexist. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I guess it kind of was, I can't remember exactly the context, but if you think about it now, I guess, for one, like we were mentioning earlier, veganism and vegetarianism is actually a very natural part to our cultures. But I think that when we think about culture and heritage, we always try to refocus and think about what is authentic, you know, what is traditional. And I distinctly recall this writer, Coral Lee, and she said something like, authentic cuisine is like a relative descriptor, because like geopolitical borders shift, and those borders too are very like membranous. So similarly, authenticity is something very porous and that changes over time. And I know you kind of talked to Celestial Peach, who is Jenny Lau. Yeah, she does a lot of good work, and she writes amazing essays about authenticity and tradition and food. And I think something she wrote in her April authenticity essay really resonated with me, which is that it's more about the intention, you know, when it comes down to it. And I don't even think that our grandmas, or like their great grandmas before them, were cooking like perfect renditions, like recreations of what their grandmas cooked for them. It's only that also changes over time, and that's what is exciting about food, in a sense, you know, that it changes over time and people change with them and taste change. And yeah, I think that it's just part of food and eating that it is so fluid, and it's hard to navigate because you want to hold on to what is true. But I think it is the act of discovery and like the journey of trying to find it that, you know, can be fun. Yeah. So we can just try. But I do understand what you mean about pork, because my papa, my grandma is like Hakka, and I recall like a few weeks back I was falling into a wormhole, because I remember she used to make these like small black cakes. I don't know what the term is. I think they're black bean cakes, but in Hakka is teo tekang. Yeah. And it's basically a very compact kueh-like substance with black beans, and it focuses on ground pork inside along with mandarin peel. And I was thinking about it because I recalled how my mom would like be actually secretly super happy whenever my papa would bring it over for her, even though they kind of like talk in a very like bickering way that is typical of many Chinese families, you understand, right? Yeah. So I was trying to think about what it would mean for me to hold on to this, because even when I tried searching for a recipe, it was so difficult to find on the internet. There are so little resources, and the idea of it just like disappearing is so, yeah, it makes you really panic on the inside. I can't let this go away. Yeah. And I don't have any answers to that still. I've found a few recipes, and it's so interesting to read about the technique, but it focuses on so much pork. And like, even though I'm used to veganizing recipes, for me it was really like, what do I replace this with? I can't like serve people mashed up tofu with black bean, right? It's not really the same. Yeah, so it is a journey, but I do think that we will be richer for going through that process of like examination and exploration. Yeah, and it's kind of fun.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's like reconciling different parts of your identity, right? Like your identity of being Hakka with your identity as someone who wants to do better for the environment and eat healthily and things like that. So in that sense, when you approach cooking vegetables in your own kitchen, how do you make them taste delicious? Because, you know, vegetables, to be honest, you know, a vegetable can never match up to meat in terms of texture, in terms of the umami. Vegetables have so much water. So how do you make them taste good?
Honestly, I feel like in this case, I have a bit of privilege because I love vegetables. Yeah, it comes really naturally to me. But I do think that it is quite important to enjoy what you're eating, because I think the enjoyment we get from our food is very intimately connected to the nutritional power of the food. Like, the more you enjoy, of course, the more nutritional benefits you get to it. So I think that can really help in guiding people to consume more vegetables. Like, take salad for an instance. I hate this hangout where people have the assumption that the vegetables inside have to be raw. Like, I feel like that hinders so many people from consuming what is termed salads. But if we think of, you know, salads as simply a medley of different components, you can braise the vegetables, you can even steam them lightly, whatever it takes for you to be able to consume them in a joyful way, you know. It can be different cooked elements. Yeah, I do not like raw vegetables a lot. I mean, they're fine, but I hate arugula. So there are so many, yeah, it's kind of nasty. But there are so many ways to work around it and to make it enjoyable. Like, you can, I know, for people who don't like it in like a strong vegetal form, you can hide it under the rich nuttiness of like something like pesto, or you could really infuse it with a lot of stock by braising it into a stew. You can even make it into a cake, like that's carrot cakes or whatever. Who's to say you can't make broccoli cakes or whatever? Yeah, I do think that it's just about transforming it into something that works for you. I don't think there's any shame in like saying, like hiding vegetables, say, by like grinding them up into meatballs or whatever, or like people being scared that the nutritional benefits of the vegetables will be leached out the minute they touch like heat or something like that. Yeah, I think that's all, you know, to a certain extent, it's just theory. And I think that what a lot of studies, in fact, have backed up is that you have to enjoy the food in order to attain any nutritional benefits at all. Yeah. So I would say just find the route that works for you, and there's no shame in having to like puree them or like hide the vegetable scents. There, you won't gain anything from forcing yourself to eat like bunches of greens. Yeah,
and I think like if you were to force yourself to eat a diet that you don't like, I mean, it's not delicious to you, you would hardly stick to it, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that's how I was at the start of trying to cut down on my meat, you know. Like, I would eat a lot of, you know, what's in the West, like salad, grain bowls, thinking that it was very healthy. And then I just felt so unsatisfied, and I craved for meat even more, you know. So it was like it backfired. And so I realized that, you know, that's not how my palate works. And then I started looking at Burmese salads. I'm not sure if you've ever had Burmese salad before.
I've tried tea salad, I think, once in my life, but I haven't, there are so many of them. Yeah, I haven't tried.
Like, so there is tea leaf salad, there is what they call rainbow salad, and they basically have like so many different salads. And what I find really interesting is that they would fry different things, like fry aromatics. So they would use garlic oil or shallot oil to dress the salad. Or they would deep fried dal, and it'll be like a crunchy element to the salad, and that would be like really nice.
Yeah. So it's really an issue of like different strokes for different folks, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. So I think, you know, in Singapore, the way that we view vegetables, it's almost like an afterthought. You know, like we just, you know, when I thought about the vegetable dishes that my family would cook when I was growing up, it was just like hastily fried kangkong or you know, some other leafy vegetables. And so, you know, when I thought about reducing my meat intake and eating more vegetables, it suddenly became very unappealing because it's always so plain. So I really think that, you know, that is the mindset shift that has to happen before more Singaporeans are willing to accept eating vegetables. What do you think? I mean, what do you think is the main hindrance for a lot of Singaporeans to reduce the meat intake?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess I am quite jaded after a long while. It can be very frustrating. And I'm not even one of those like really evangelical vegans, because I do believe that everyone has to find their own path, and what's right for someone may not be right for another person. But I do think that we need to have a wider conversation about food and where it comes from and who makes our food. You know, the many myriad pains of different hands passing us even one ingredient before it comes to fate. I do believe with an informed understanding of that, we would be richer not only with like the knowledge of what options we have and are open to, but also how we feel when we consume what is on our plates. You know, I do have a lot of peers who are like, who understand that, say, McDonald's is a really terrible corporate fast food giant, but the minute they come up with like, what's the recent one? The Hainanese chicken rice burger. It's all like, oh, let's get that. Or like a BTS meal. That kind of stuff that is impossible to, at least for them in that moment, or like worth it at least to make that choice. Okay, I'm gonna get it. Yeah, I do think that a lot of it has to boil down to education. And I do think that this is as integral as, say, civics education, which we make time for every single week in primary school. And yeah, I do think that Singapore in particular has a very weird way of educating children about food. Like, on one hand, you have all these lessons about, oh, there's this like diet pyramid, this healthy pyramid, and on the bottom is that you should eat less of this when it goes up. But it's also abstracted from what you eat in everyday life, and and on the other hand, you have all these kind of like really terrible societal pressures where height and weight things are made to be this kind of like sensational thing. Every term or whatever, it's like, oh, everyone's going to the room and everyone's going to get weight, and it might be public or not, and everyone will poke fun at certain people. And even Tough Club, you think about how they were so militant as to withhold kids from recess just because they were above BMI, which is such an arbitrary number anyway, that on a study based on like white men. Yeah, we are using this to like punish students effectively instead of teaching them different ways to enjoy movement healthily, or like what they can enjoy, or like what they can perhaps reach for if their diet is concentrated in certain areas. You know, we have such a punitive and frustrating culture that is so entrenched in like fat phobia and like diet culture in general. And I think it's no wonder that a lot of people wrestle to get out of these very innate complications around food. And even now we are in such a middle of such a like tidal wave of food-based medicine, right? Like healthy eating books, or like the idea that certain foods can kill you and certain other foods can save you. But I think that these kind of, it's so easy to slip from that into other kinds of holistic healthcare and like mass paranoia around food and eating. And I think a lot of sensationalism around that is what drove a lot of people away from veganism in the first place. Like in the early 2010s, there was this like whole social media movement with really scarring. It was cultish in a sense, because it was called high carb, low fat, and people would just like stay away from fat like it was the plague. And that's a lot of the reason why a lot of people jump to certain conclusions about veganism in the first place. And the underlying assumption of all these kind of like diets or nutritional models is that you can figure out the ingredients to happiness and like eat your way to some modicum of perfect health. But I think our bodies and brains are like much more endlessly complex, and in a sense like more knowledgeable than we can ever imagine. Like, no matter what you do, there's no certain way to guarantee health. You get what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I mean, without a doubt, if you just drink nothing but Coca-Cola and eat, say, like, fried chicken every second day, it's not going to lead you to your best self, but neither would a fully sanitized diet of, like, you know, salad bowls with a sense of puritanism. You know, we can't write a recipe for happiness, you know.
Yeah.
It's impossible to predict, yeah.
And I think we have a very cookie cutter image of health, right? I mean, especially for girls. I mean, the image of a healthy female now is like someone who does yoga, sun salutation in the morning, and then drinks green juice. Kind of, I mean, that image is so tied to veganism, right? Is it not?
Yeah, I think that's what happens when a lot of people, again, previously take their first impulse of veganism to be something quite and hence Western and very like isolated from not only the understanding of why people choose veganism in the first place, but by the way that it is everywhere and so like part and parcel of our everyday life and culture. Yeah. And to a certain extent, I guess it's understandable that people subscribe to certain notions because they are concerned for their health. But I think that we also have to remember that food is something that it's not like a bad boyfriend, you get what I mean? It's not something you have to run away from or like be scared from. You have to find joy in it, and it's different from for everyone, and what's right for you may not be right from someone else. Or systems are so complex, and and there's just a lot of terrible wellness talk out there. And I just think that what's healthiest and what's most joyful is sitting down with people you love and having a really good meal, or like having the success of cooking something really nice for yourself and enjoying it after having a really bad day. That kind of restoration you feel on a physical and emotional level, and I think that does more for you than any sort of prescribed set of like health pyramid or whatever can do.
Yeah.
Or like someone drinking juices every morning.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Can I ask, did you always have this positive relationship with food? Was it something that was very ingrained in you when you were growing up?
I wouldn't say that my relationship with food has always been like super joyful. I think because I struggled a lot with depression. I still do for more than half of my life, and that can affect not only my appetite for food, but for life in general. And but I definitely think that I've had my Instagram page for a while, and I've been cooking and baking for myself, and being online for this long, with open inverted commas, has good and bad, and there's the good and bad to it, is what I mean to say. But I think that I've learned a lot from seeing different movements come and go, and how and what really inspires longevity and what is right. And I think, I mean, right for me. Yeah, and I think that reading from many different food writers that I really admire also helps, because it does help to widen my and broaden my previously narrow concepts of what food is and what eating is in general. Yeah, so I think that what is really helpful in this case is like a willingness to learn. Yeah, because if I was really stringent on ideas of food, say like 6 years back, they would be really antiquated now, and people learn more with time. So yeah, I'm glad that I have moved on. Yeah.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh. I have one last question for you, and that is, what do you hope to see shift in Singaporean food culture in the coming years?
I hope that Singaporeans will be open to giving more to learning about food and giving more in terms of heart space, certainly, like just being willing to listen to so many people, like all the people on your podcast doing many amazing things for the Singaporean food scene, and to understand how things get onto our plate and why they are on our plate, who makes our food, because we will be so much happier for that, and the food will taste so much sweeter for that. But, and I also think that, I don't know, I hope that people can also be critical about things like plant-based meat or things that come out in a very greenwashing manner, because those aren't sustainable as well in the long run. And I know that it's a very tricky minefield to navigate, but I just hope that there can be a willingness to learn, because there's a lot at stake now. I'm sure you also feel that as well. And especially with these few years, with many different reports coming out and many things happening in general, it just comes to a point where you can either choose like absolute nihilism or try to do your best. And of course, everyone is imperfect. I also can't say that I'm like living a carbon-free, you know, like existence as a vapor. But I think what matters is the trying. And yeah, I think that can move us to a place where we enjoy our food more and learn about each other as well. Yeah.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I think you're such a sweet person. I'm so happy that we meet. Like, no, even if it's just through Zoom, but you know, it's really.
I'm so happy to meet you. You're so like inspirational, and you've done so much for the food scene, and to just like collect so many voices and just have these conversations in the first place about food and appetites. To have this kind of like candid, honest conversation really brings together a lot of people. I think what matters is that you started in the first place. It's not that people don't want to talk about this, that someone has to ask the first question, and you did. And it's so wonderful to see so many communities just like come together and be like, well, let's all make our own sambal this weekend, you know? Yeah, it's so amazing what you're doing. Like, Pamina, well, thank you so much.
I love what you're doing, so continue doing it. I love seeing your bread, your shreddable bread. That wraps up another episode of the Singapore Noodles Podcast. You have been listening to Gan Xin Lin of Tumblin' Bumblin' Crumblin' Cookie. Food media in Singapore tends to focus on the best hits like chicken rice or laksa and fails to capture the diversity of Singaporean food. By documenting overlooked recipes, Singapore Noodles seeks to share about Singapore's rich food culture with you. If you would like to support the work that we do, you can sign up to be a member on our website, sgpnoodles.com. You'll get access to all of the recipes on the site and participate in monthly cook-alongs. Once again, thank you for listening to the podcast, and I'll catch you next week. Thank you.